Hi everyone, Mark Brown from Microsoft Virtual Earth. Welcome to our second episode of Behind the Maps. Today we're in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, home of Keystone Aerial Surveys, who owns and operates a number of the ultracams that are used to collect the aerial imagery for Microsoft Virtual Earth. We'll talk to a pilot and some of the crew who operate the camera and find out some more details about what it takes to get the great imagery you see in Virtual Earth today. So welcome to Behind the Maps. Hi everybody, Mark Brown from Microsoft Virtual Earth, and I'm here in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania at Keystone Aerial Surveys, one of the companies that flies the Ultracam around and gathers all the imagery in Virtual Earth. And today with me, I've got a couple of guys that work for the company here. You guys want to introduce yourselves and tell me a little bit about you?
Okay, I'm Ken Potter, and I am the Executive Vice President for Keystone Aerial Surveys.
I'm Neil DeFranco. I'm a survey pilot and the senior project manager at Keystone Aerial Surveys.
Great. So, Ken, tell me a little bit about Keystone. Just kind of just all about Keystone, what you guys do.
Okay. Keystone is a company that just collects imagery. We're not a fully integrated mapping company. In other words, we don't produce maps. We've been in business for 40-plus years. We're a woman-owned company. Relatively small. We have about 47 employees. And our main base is right out of Northeast Philadelphia Airport. We have a satellite base in Benson, Arizona. We operate 14 aircraft and fly all over the United States collecting imagery. Most of our imagery has been, in the past, of course, has been collected with analog film cameras. We still operate about 12 film cameras. And over the last 3 years, we've moved into the digital, first with the Ultracam D in 2005. We started with a D. Yep. And it was around Thanksgiving, I believe, 2005. We upgraded to the X, then bought another X and another X. So right now we have three Ultracam Xs flying all over the United States.
Great. And you guys cover all the U.S. for us, essentially, right?
Yes. We're working on permits for Canada and Mexico at this time.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, we need some imagery for Mexico, so.
Good. We're going to be ready to go here. We're going through the NAFTA permits now, and we should be ready to go in a couple of months.
Great. So tell me a little bit about, you know, operating this thing and what you guys do. How many folks work as, like, ground crew on the aircraft?
We have four full-time mechanics based here, and this is our main maintenance base. They just work on our aircraft. That's in terms of the maintenance. In terms of the support for the cameras, we have a full black and white film lab that develops and processes all our imagery. Four scanners where we can turn that analog imagery into digital. And then in terms of our ultracams, we have the full IT department, which I'm sure you're going to get a little tour of later with Dave Day. And we process the imagery to the needs of the client. For Virtual Earth, they like it. They want it processed to a level 2. Other clients want it processed to a level 3, whether it be color, infrared. And so we have our IT support system designed and built to supply whatever needs our clients require.
All right, cool. So aside from the ground crew then, how many folks work on the aircraft and operate this thing when you're actually out there gathering imagery?
When we go out on the road, we go out with two people. One is a pilot, Neil, and an operator, which today you'll be probably flying with one of our operators. And they handle all the data acquisition, ground station setup, if we require ground station setup, and downloading the data, QCing, whatever QCing they can do in flight and after the flight. The DX units are then sent back to Philadelphia where we download the data and ship them back to the crews in the field. So we just operate with two people.
Oh, okay. It's a pretty lightweight.
Yes. Well, there's a lot of equipment you have to carry because we have the ability with the Ultracam, with the DX units, we can change DX units in flight. So we don't have the problem of the past where you were limited to the amount of acquisition you could make. We actually carry extra DX units. Normally the aircraft gets dispatched with four DX units, so we can do, what, 8,400 exposures, which is a lot of collection. Yeah, that's a lot of collection. And then you're normally carrying some, you know, these guys will go up for weeks and months at a time, and they'll have their bags and everything else. So we found that the PA-31, the Navajo Chieftain, had been pretty good for the ability for crew comfort and for production. So a larger size airplane is more for the crew comfort than necessary. You could put it in a 300 series Cessna, but you're kind of limited in space.
Yeah. So Neil, I wanted to ask you kind of about some of the details around, you know, flying this thing when you're doing these missions to capture data. So how long is each flight?
It could range from a half an hour upwards to 5 hours, depending on the fuel load. You know, usually we're looking at 4 hour missions for a decent collect for Virtual Earth.
How many square miles in, say, 4 hours are you able to capture?
On a good day, like perfect conditions, nice and clear, no issues with ATC, we could probably collect an entire AOI, which would be, you know, roughly 1,000 images the way they're set up right now, which is roughly 100 square miles.
Are there restrictions kind of around the time of year you can fly in? I mean, is one season better than another, or?
Well, it depends on who we're working for. When we're working for Virtual Earth, there really aren't restrictions for when we collect things. We'll collect in the winter. We'll collect in the summer, fall, and spring. Now, normal mapping, normally fall and spring when the leaves are off the trees. But because of the collect for Virtual Earth, they don't really care as much about the leaves. I'm sure in the future they might care a little bit more. But for now, we're not limited. And even recently, we've been doing some ski area collects. So they've relaxed some of the snow requirements. In the past, if there was any snow, we couldn't collect. And now certain times they want, you know, a little bit of snow on the ski slope if you're collecting imagery of a ski slope.
Yeah, right, so, right. How about the time of day? Does that play
absolutely
a big part of it?
Yeah, we try and operate at, you know, the highest 5 hours of sun angle. Now, depending on the time of year, you know, wintertime, you may only get 2 hours, 3 hours, depending on how low the sun
is. So your latitude would matter as well, I guess.
Absolutely. The normal collection would be, say, 30 degrees of sun angle. Summertime, that's a quite a large window.
Yeah. So. That's great. Are there other considerations in terms of, you know, just around when you can and cannot fly that that kind of play a part of that?
Well, you have issues with airspace, and a lot of times you wouldn't fly in an airspace during their busy periods with airlines. Sometimes we have to get a coordinated slot in a restricted airspace, which sets us to a specific time. Other times, non-Microsoft clients may have, say, a tide job, which requires the flight at a low or a high tide, or both.
Oh, really?
So sometimes we'll collect it twice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Other times, downtown areas, low flights, when you want to deal with minimizing the cloud shadow off, or not cloud shadow, but the building shadow. Sometimes you need to acquire that with the highest sun angle so that you're not blocking out the downtown streets.
Yep. So, Ken, I wanted to ask, how is the flying for us different with respect to, you know, the quality and the type of imagery you're gathering, like, versus others? And I guess kind of like, because I know the 3D stuff requires a little bit different, I guess, in terms of how you're setting up the camera and how you're flying those things. Is there?
Well, for Virtual Earth, what we're doing, all the city collects are 60% side lap and 80% forward overlap. And when we get into the dense part of the city, we go to 90% forward overlap, which gives them multiple views of the areas in the city, which allows them to do the 3D modeling a lot better.
So that's, are you flying, I mean, that camera's probably snapping pictures then pretty fast at that.
They are.
That overlap.
Yeah, with the UCX, we can take a picture every 1.35 seconds. So even at 90% forward overlap, an airplane like this, we can still fly at 150 knots.
Wow.
Yeah, which is great.
Yeah, that's good. At least well above stall speed, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And this is at 15 centimeter GSD. Very good.
Wow, that's fascinating. That's fascinating.
It is.
So, Neil, just one last question. So can you kind of tell me about how you plan your flights and how that whole process kind of works? I mean, I'm guessing it's different because it's so precise, I guess, with respect to just getting up and kind of asking for clearance and then heading off some direction, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And later we'll go over some of the software, planning the actual imagery and also coordinating with air traffic control. We've tried to develop software and take off-the-shelf software to the next level so that our pilots have the most information possible to get into the airspace, send a flight map to ATC, and once they're up there, they know exactly where they're going to be and when they're going to be there. So, you know, most of the planning of the actual flight lines is done through our, you know, the X-Track software, which is provided, well, purchased from TrackAir, which also designed the flight management system. Once those flight lines are created, based on the specs of 80% forward, 60% side, and also the 90% forwards at that 15 centimeter, we know where the flight lines are going to be, and we can then take that into another software package, which was designed in-house. We call it ATC Maps, and it basically just shows the flight line grid. We can show our lead-in little chevrons that lead into the flight line, so ATC knows that we're not just going to start taking pictures right where the line is. We actually have to set up and come inbound. You know, give us
get your speed right and your altitude right. And
nice and level and straight. And once we send that over to ATC, it basically is just an overlay with sometimes we can show them what they actually see on their scope when they're working the actual traffic, and then other times we just show them the vector maps of the airspace, which most pilots see on the flight maps. So
yeah, and what kind of, you need special clearance to fly these routes that you're doing, or is there anything different than if you were just flying through airspace normally? Or
normally when you're going to fly through airspace, you call them up and you ask for flight following or transit through their airspace. For this, we're going to be loitering. They don't like that. So we're literally flying back and forth all day long. And, you know, we try and build a relationship with the air traffic controllers, call them up ahead of time, provide them with the map, ask them if there's any other information that they might need to feel better about us being there. Some jobs, say, like the ski areas that we're working on now, they're flying higher at 30 centimeters. And once you get out west, they're much higher, above 18,000 feet, which is a whole nother ball game for airspace. This is actually Class A airspace, which is used for most IFR traffic in the airliners. So that requires different clearances and different altitudes. And so sometimes it becomes difficult, especially when you throw military areas, restricted airspace, prohibited airspace. Sometimes you have to coordinate through many different levels.
So does it take a lot of time then to get these kinds of clearances? Because people are always saying, you know, when are you going to get me imagery for my neighborhood, right? And I say, well, there's a lot that goes into it, but it sounds to me like it could take a lead time of a few months probably to get things kind of worked out. Or is it...
tell them the story about we just collected for you guys and another customer of Washington, D.C., and it took literally months to get the clearances. And when the final flight, Neil had to fly with the Secret Service agent in the airplane.
Oh.
It was the only way that they'd let us fly in over the White House. Couldn't fly when Congress is in session. And
well, so those guys are never ever.
Just weekends.
This weekend, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, so weekends. And then the permitting process, going through all these different layers of security, and then actually having to go down there, land, pick up a Secret Service agent, and fly with him to make sure we were doing
it. And then the weather's got to cooperate too, right? So, I mean, do you often go and get clearance for stuff and then sit on the tarmac waiting for weather to break? Or?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the job that Ken is speaking of right now, we made numerous attempts to get the last flight in. You know, we'd go down there and the clouds pop. So here you're trying to coordinate sun angle, weather, and then on top of that, let's say it's crystal clear but hazy. If it's too hazy, you're not going to take imagery that's worth anything.
Yeah.
So there's too many things that have to fall into place just to get this flight perfect. It's rare for that level of complication to come into play. But it does happen, and we're used to things like that.
Yeah.
We've been dealing with it, as Ken said, for a very long time.
Well, that's fascinating. I kind of knew that there was a lot that kind of went into it, and why, you know, we always say, you know, we don't know when we're going to have your neighborhood, right? Because there's just, even once we call you guys and say, hey, we'd love to get a flyover, there's all this stuff that you guys have to do to go and prepare for it. So,
yeah.
Well, you know what, Neil, I'd love to get a demo of this software. So just check out how the flight planning happens, and then we'll check that out and then go fly.
Sounds like a plan.
Great.
All right.
Thanks, guys. Okay, Neil. So you want to kind of give me a run through on how you do your flight planning for UltraCam?
Absolutely. I'm going to skip a couple steps here, just assuming that we have the AOI loaded into the software already.
What's AOI?
The AOI is Area of Interest, and Microsoft will provide us with a number of AOIs at a time or just a specific one so that we can do, you know, whatever city they'd like us to acquire next. So basically, at this point, we already have the AOI in the system. It's basically just a vector shape file of what we're going to take pictures of.
Okay.
So for this demo, I'm going to use Philadelphia. All right, so We're using the X-Track software suite manufactured by TrackAir. This goes with our flight management system. It's very tightly integrated. The software we're looking at right now is SnapPlan. And now SnapPlan is actually going to take the AOI. It's going to take the parameters for the flight lines and just plot them. All right.
Okay.
So I'm just going to go and start a new flight plan and select the project. So this is just a test project that I'm going to pull out of our planning folder. Give me a second. Find Philadelphia. And here we select our camera. We'll pick a digital camera. Up at the top here, we have the Microsoft UltraCam X and our parameters, 15 centimeter GSD, which is the standard right now for Microsoft projects. And we have 60% side lap, 80% forward overlap. And we press OK. And there is the area of interest. It's roughly in the shape of Philadelphia. They collected a little bit less when we flew it the first time. So here, I just plot the lines north-south as we fly everything for them. And at this point, we can almost take this and fly it. Every blue line represents a run. And if I bring up the photo locations, every red circle, red dot, represents where a picture is going to be triggered. Okay? We can show the neat model of the coverage. This is basically the stereo area. And here you can zoom in and see how it covers the area of interest pretty completely.
Yeah.
All right. Now, the next thing you have to do before we can go and fly it, we have to give it some sort of terrain elevation. If we just fly it at 15 centimeters, it's above sea level. We'll end up losing forward overlap or side lap or, you know, whatever it may be. It's not going to come out the way they want it. So we have to load terrain somehow. Now, the old way is you just put in the terrain that you know is there. What we like to do is actually load a digital elevation model behind the flight plan, and it gives us a very accurate terrain.
And this makes sure that you're exactly that altitude above ground, not just above sea level.
That's
just,
right.
Okay.
That's makes right. Sense. So here I'm just going to go and extract the DEM area from the USGS. And this takes a couple minutes depending on the size of the project. It's almost done. Got 50%. Now, this is a newer development in the last couple of years. It's made us a lot, increased our accuracy pretty substantially.
This isn't something you'd need to do in, like, in Texas.
Well,
it's flat.
Regardless of whether it's flat or not, we tend to do this anyway.
Yeah.
Just to.
No, no, just to improve your accuracy, yeah.
Right. So here, basically, we're just looking. I don't have to change anything here because nothing is going to violate the specs. But basically, it's adding 26 feet for some of the flight lines and 200 feet for other flight lines. So, you know, normally I will spool through this and just make sure we're not violating anything. We can see a 10% high, 10% low. Philadelphia is not very hilly, so it's not going to matter.
It'll visualize. It'll point out if you've got something that's out of the bounds, so
exactly.
To speak.
Exactly. You'd see a lot of red showing up. We can actually view here the stereo coverage. Because we do 80%, everything is green. If it was 60%, you'd see some green and yellow.
And so this thing will actually, when this thing figures all this stuff out and you put it on this stick,
yeah.
It'll actually, does it actually fly the aircraft like autopilot style, or does
no,
it tell you what to do?
It basically just provides horizontal and vertical guidance for the pilot.
Okay.
So very accurate guidance. So here I'm just going to hit close, and the terrain is actually set at this point. I can view it, and here it's set various terrain elevations for every flight line. Click close here. And at this point, I can just save the project. And we'll call it something like Test Philadelphia. And we can take this to the airplane now and fly it. Now, for our test flight today, we're going to do something a little bit different. I'm going to exit out of this software. We're going to fly up New Jersey, Philadelphia, or New Jersey, Pennsylvania border and just do a couple little flight lines. So I'm going to extract an area. Instead of using a vector area of interest, we're just going to take a background map, a raster graphic, and we're going to just plot our flight lines on that.
Okay.
So here I'm going to extract this area like so and give it a name. We'll call it Test Flight. Hit Enter. I'm just going to save this under a project I have called Test. And then take that back over to the SnapPlan software. Like so, we'll pick our digital camera, and we're going to do this at say 3,000 feet, which is roughly 6.6 centimeters. And we'll set this for 60% forward overlap and 30% side lap. And we'll hit OK there. So now our tools are a little bit different. It's not going to calculate the runs automatically for us. What I'll do is just draw what I want to fly. So here's one flight line like so. And then I can copy it over at 30%. Relatively easy interface to work
with. Wow, that is cool.
So there's our flight lines. We've got three of them. We see the photo centers. We'll do the same thing with terrain that we did last time. This will run a lot faster because the area is much smaller. And once this is finished, because there's a little bit more relief in this area, you'll see the influence of the terrain on the flight line a little bit more. Okay. So now when I select the flight line, we're still within spec, but you see the green area is representing the variations in terrain as we...
Oh, I see, as it goes up and down right there.
Yeah, it just varies a little bit. And it picks the average terrain for the flight line. So we've got 213 feet for one of them, 250 for another, and 276 for another. So now we'll hit close, and that is saved. And I will save this flight plan as test flight again. Hit OK. Now, I'll also show you our planning software. It helps us interface with air traffic control. And for that, we have to create a small text file that we'll use in another program. So let me just create that file. I'm going to put that on my desktop. And we'll close that. So this project is done at this point. I saved it. I can close out of this. And I can close out of this. Let me just grab my memory stick. You have to have a way to transfer your data to the aircraft computer before you fly. We use a standard USB memory key.
How big does it have to be?
You can get away with a very small one, 256, but you can't buy anything that small most times.
Not anymore. You can get them free at trade shows now.
Yeah, exactly. So now we're just going to open up another piece of the software package and export this flight plan onto the stick. So we'll just say export, and we'll go down to our test project. Where did I have it? And I'll grab my test flight, which is right there, and hit apply. It's really just an access database inside a zip file.
Oh, really? Okay.
The only reason they put in a zip file is so if you email it, your email software doesn't weed it out.
Right.
So once that runs through, we'll transfer it to the memory stick.
So that thing basically just got that file, just a bunch of lat longs in it, really. It's just...
That's the meat of it. There's a little bit more data than that. There's a lot of side data, like the type of film or the type of camera, the crew. A lot of things are set up. They might be empty fields that get populated once you fly the job, but... You know, it's basically just lat long.
Yeah.
Very cool. So, and we'll just transfer this directly to the memory stick. Computer's running a little slow today.
That's all right.
We say okay. And it's done. Okay. So now, the coordination map I was talking about, here's our text file. I'm just going to... Now, this software package is something we designed in-house to help our pilots. And I just need to weed out some of the jobs we flew over the weekend. And I'll run the software package. It's basically just going to give us some flight lines and airspace. And then the phone number of, you know, the controlling agency that we would want to talk with. Now, for this job, we really don't need to coordinate with anybody. So this is really just an example.
Oh, so this will give you the frequency that you talk to the air traffic control folks when
you're flying? Phone numbers and fax numbers, so we can fax us some ahead of time, talk with them ahead of time.
Oh, file your flight plan with them.
Got it, essentially.
Okay.
So here, press OK, map the job, give ourselves a 5-mile lead. All right, so here we go. This is pretty much the area we're going to be flying. We're down here at Northeast Philadelphia. And we'll take off, fly north, and there's our job. So you can some things around so that the map is a little bit more legible for ATC. And then we can go here and say, create a map for printing. You can put in your tail number or your call sign and the type of airplane. For this, we'll say PA. one. Flight date today is, it's 28th, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
Say roughly, close enough, right?
Yeah, yeah.
10 o'clock. And this gives us a nice little map, which we then print out. And I can throw those phone numbers on if I want. And it tells us there's no contact info because it's not in anybody's airspace. This is essentially what we would print in fax. And that's our flight planning.
Wow, that's really cool. And I love how it's all graphical and just shows you exactly what you need. So
we try and give the pilots and the photographers as much information as possible so that the job goes, you know, smooth and safe.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks, Neil. Let's go fly.
All right, let's do it.
Thanks.
Northeast Tower, footprint 153, holding short 33, ready for takeoff.
Footprint 153, Northeast Tower, runway 33, cleared for takeoff, direction.
Cleared for takeoff, we're going to be northbound, footprint 153.
Okay, cleared right.
Footprint 153, on course,
cleared left. Let's do this.
So, Mark, do you have any questions at this point?
No, I was just watching the UltraCam cruise around in this gimbal.
The PAP 30 is a fantastic. It does take a few minutes to cycle through its self-leveling procedures.
Yeah, you can see it moving around.
It's finding its own center, and it's adapting to its environment. All right, reconnecting.
Reconnecting. So is this thing, like, gyro-stabilized, this whole platform it's sitting on right now?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yeah, you can tell when you hit a bump, it moved.
Okay. All right. Track.
Everything's good. Very good. All right, so all systems are go. We're pretty close to our altitude. What I'm going to do is go ahead and select our first line.
Let me pull a exposure test first.
Sure thing. I'll just start setting up for the line. You do your tests.
There's two different types of tests. We do a ground test, which is an overexposed test, just to make sure all of the camera cones and sensors are actually working. They'll heavily blow the image out, overexpose it by about two stops or so. This tells us that the cones themselves are actually working. Take a standard test exposure for our imagery. It's a short hold rather than a long hold. And this is how we fine-tune our exposure. We're operating in normal photographic parameters with apertures and shutter speeds. So at F11, at 250th of a second, on this light meter bar here, you can tell that we're within acceptable parameters for the image.
Yeah, cool. So Ben, you tell me when you're ready.
We're good to go. Exposure is correct.
All right, so I'm going to go ahead and pick our first line here. We'll start with line one. And the UltraCam's not ready, and now it is. Very good. Okay, so here we go. We're at altitude, and we're just going to come in and pick up our line. So the software here, Mark, is providing us with a lot of information. We've got vertical guidance from the bar on the left, and at the bottom we've got horizontal guidance to the flight line.
Oh, I see. Here we go.
I also have the ability to click around on this screen and give position reports or intended position reports to air traffic control based on known VORs and radials in the area. So that helps out a lot when trying to coordinate inside airspace. Basically, if you can see his bottom screen there, wherever I put this mouse pointer, the yellow triangle shows up, and that gives us information at the top. It's saying the Solberg 245 at 11. And then here in track up mode, it gives us very precise guidance to the flight line once we're within, say, 90 degrees of the desired track and also a mile and a half of the center line. All right. So once we get online, once we're about 45 seconds out, we'll see this little blue box in the upper right-hand corner where it says frozen. That's the mount. And at 45 seconds, it'll unlock and it'll go yellow. And at about 30 seconds, it'll go green. And that means the mount is active, it's stabilizing itself, and it's accepting drift inputs from the drift source, which is, in this case is the IMU. Okay.
Has a maximum tilt capacity of about 5 degrees either way, so we have very specific limitations in the amount of turbulence and the amount of rough air that we can fly through.
Now, if you get knocked off more than that, do you just come back and try and capture it again?
We
have
to re-fly it.
Well, we right now we're 2 minutes out still, so I'm really not online. I'm just establishing at this point. I'm not trying to bank too abruptly with the extra passengers in the plane. But here you can see the horizontal bars coming back in, so I'll just make some slight corrections and come back to the center line, and we'll try and hold that. So we're online at this point. We'll do a final system check. I'm good up here. Ben, if you can confirm systems back there, we'll
do 5x5.
Very good. Minute 30.
Now it's rolling, and we have drift.
Okay, 20 seconds. Everything's good. Ten.
Yes.
I said 10. Oh. 6. Coming up on photos. Okay, I've got feedback. We're good. Taking pictures. 1 minute till the end of the line.
As part of our quality control platform, it is one of my responsibilities to monitor all 13 of these CCDs for any recording errors, any possible lens problems, whether it be grit, dust, any atmospheric conditions, whether it's water, moisture, vapor.
So those 9 CCDs, those are the 4 panchromatic black and white high-res, right?
Yes, these are the 9 high-res panchromatic and the 4 red, green, blue, infrared.
Yeah, cool.
When tracking cloud cover issues, the infrared is critical because clouds are, it's almost a black and white, it's perfect. It shows it very, very well.
Yeah.
Let's just say the shadow on the ground through the infrared spectrum.
Okay, line is complete, waiting for the mount to cage.
Mount is frozen.
Mount is frozen. Very good. We'll set up for our next line.
Because of our location of our antenna, which is surveyed directly over the camera itself, we have a 30-degree bank angle requirement where we cannot exceed that. If we do, we have gaps in our GPS data, which is not cohesive with the deliverable product. So we are under specific operating parameters.
And a lot of clients will require us to keep it as low as 20 degrees. Because this is a test flight, I'm just kind of doing whatever.
That is rolling.
Mount is rolling. Very good.
I see. So there it goes. When it changes to yellow right there, right?
Yep. And then once it completely finds itself, it goes green. Okay, 30 seconds.
Yeah, our drifting.
Systems are good. Very good.
This gives us the angle of our drift. We're 1.9 degrees to the right.
So off center line?
Yes.
Well, the aircraft is actually crabbed into the wind, so what the mount is doing is taking that out and aligning the camera with the actual track. So you can see here, I'm actually flying this a little bit off, so I can come back to the right, and the drift will actually change.
But at the end of each day of flying, have to physically check each individual photograph taken, part of our quality control. So if it's been a long flight day, anywhere around 6 to 8 hours, we could have a few thousand images that we have to check one at a
time. Oh, man.
It gets a little tedious, but it saves a lot of time in the long run by not letting things go undone.
Yeah.
If we have a reflight called in the laboratory days later and we have to ferry back to a location we've already left and completed, it's really not an efficient use of materials. The flight management system makes it easy to track days of flight and the production numbers as they are, because they batch the imagery into roll numbers, which is transcends over from when we were flying primarily film. And all the imagery flown today is cataloged with a reference number in roll.
That's a unique reference number.
And inside of that, each one of the images is labeled specifically to what job that it is.
So everything's tagged.
So we can fly multiple jobs during the day on one single roll, and everything's tagged.
Yeah, cool.
It can be a little draining sometimes in terms of the scatterbrain nature of trying to monitor 17 things all at once, but realistically, I have to keep an eye on the IMU and make sure that it's constantly logging GPS data.
Oh, okay.
The TESI box, which is catalog GPS data, power, camera, firing signals, pilot's display, so if he has an issue in flight, I have to trace wires and try to isolate the specific issue, the problem. I have to quality control the imagery as they come through while monitoring the center marks for where the images are actually taken in flight management, while also keeping an eye on the mount to make sure we're within the specific limit.
Okay, that's a wrap.
Now that we're done with the job for the day, we're going to exit out of the recording menu. We're immediately going to go into verify mode, which creates the image redundancy on both storage DXs. At the same time, I'm going to exit out of our flight management system and go into the storage capacity for our flight management.
Got it.
To select the day or the roll in which all these images were shot in and verify that they are, well, basically reject all of the images that are unnecessary. For instance, this is a test image, so that automatically gets rejected because otherwise it would become confusing.
It's really hard to see. It's getting tossed around pretty hard. That's cool. So everything color codes the images that are good. We actually won't accept the imagery until it's checked back in the lab.
Got
at that point, they'll turn green, but for now, they're blue, meaning unchecked.
Any red basically means automatically rejected and thrown in the trash. So any test exposures or faulty exposures or bad runs.
Got it.
So if I back out of this and click on blue, it'll show that the project was shot in total. And then if I click on red, zoom out, you'll see all of our rejected test shots.
Oh, there it is, yeah.
Now you want to be doing ground shots while at the airport to make sure that the camera is operational and you don't have any immediate lens cone failures, because if you do, it really makes no sense to go fly.
Yep.
But also when you get to the job at the correct desired elevation or altitude in the same conditions, if we're going to be shooting in a heavily urbanized area and do test shots in a heavily ruralized area, the imagery could show up completely differently.
Got it.
So under the same conditions, we have to do our tests. So you could quite possibly have tests right next to your job and at a greater distance.
Yeah, makes sense.
So after the images have been verified, so now both DXs contain a mirror image of all of the data. have to physically view. Make sure that each cone fired correctly, exposed correctly. Correct sequence. Now, in the case of many thousands of images, your fingers are relatively tired.
All right, so Mark, once you guys finish up back there, if I could have you come back up and strap in.
Sounds good.
We'll set up the landing.
Yeah, and we'll go check out what you guys do with this imagery once we get back down.
No sounds like a plan.
Cool.
Wing 2205. Footprint 153, turn left, taxiway Alpha, contact ground point 7, exiting.
Okay, left on Alpha, ground point 7, footprint 153.
Okay, everybody, so we're back from the airplane and back at Keystone and hanging out now on the back end of this whole acquisition thing. So what I've got is one of the guys who does all the pipeline processing, or the beginning of the pipeline processing for all the imagery that comes into Virtual Earth. So you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, hi, my name's David Day. I'm Director of IT here at Keystone, and I'm going to walk you through what we do when the DX unit comes back from the airplane, either whether it's locally or on the road, and how we get it out to Microsoft. So,
So walk us through it here. What the?
Yeah, initially the DX unit comes back and it comes onto this docking station from Microsoft. It's on the back end. It has four InfiniBand outputs, which are four channels of SATA data coming out at the same time. So we split that down to four different computers so that we can download the 1.7 terabytes within 3 to 4 hours. So it's a nice turnaround. If we get the data in from FedEx around 10, we can ship it by 4 o'clock that afternoon. And with the speed of the SATA, we're able to quickly dump the data either across a network if the network traffic's pretty slow, or most of the time when we have multiple cameras on the field, we'll download them to terabyte drives, standalone SATA or USB terabyte drives. And like I said, that whole operation can take about 4 hours, and then we quickly move it into our back room, our processing center, where it's attached to a SAN, which we have 30 terabytes of available disk space for that storage.
And then do you do anything else? I mean, 30 terabytes doesn't hold too much, I guess, these days. So,
If we were doing full processing like Microsoft's doing, sure, we would need a lot more. But the nice thing is we bring it in, we immediately back it up on tape twice, and then we process it and to level two, which is what Microsoft takes, and we put it right back on the terabyte drives and ship them out. As soon as they're out the door, they've been backed up twice, we can go ahead and clear off the SAN.
Got it.
And get it ready for the next one.
Okay.
So I describe it as a 30 terabyte floppy disk, basically. We just dump the data on there, copy it off, do what we need to, and then
just temp right storage, off. Basically, because
yep.
Tape is where it's archived on to for you guys.
Exactly. It's archived onto LTO3 tape.
Okay. So a few hours to get it off that big unit that just came off the aircraft, and then you're putting them on those little terabyte drives right there, and then processing it to the level two?
Yes.
Okay.
Which is, I don't know, I guess we could show you over here how that happens.
Yeah, let's take a look.
And what level two is.
Let's take a look.
Initially, when it comes in, it's considered level zero. So we would take a job. I think we probably have a Microsoft job on here. And this is the software from Microsoft that comes with the camera. It's called Office Processing Center. And you select your level zero area, raw data, 13 individual images, 9 of them black and white, red, green, blue, and
color IR. That's right. So one from each CCD,
yes.
Right? And they're all basically individual images. Is that right?
Exactly. They're all individual standalone images. And what this is, as it's importing it here, it's going to confirm that all 13 images are there, they're correct, and there's no issues with them. If this was incorrect, you can see that it says 13 of 13. If there's something wrong, it would actually tell us right here at this screen.
Got it.
For the level 2 processing, from 0 to 2, it's nothing exciting to show you except you highlight the images, you select where you want it to go, and you click process. However, it is the most time-consuming step that takes about 4 to 5 minutes per image, and is actually taking those 9 pan images and using the camera calibrations. Each camera that we have has a specific calibration of how those 9 black and white images fit together. So it goes in and actually seams them together and creates one large, high-resolution panchromatic image.
So this is the, okay, so the 200 final 216-megapixel image.
Yep, and that's brought together at this step.
So are all the channels then combined at that point, and you end up with one thing, or are they still all separated as well?
The pan comes as one, and the color is actually what's called a four-band image. It's red, green, blue, and color IR in one image.
Okay.
So if you just wanted a black and white image at this point, you have a deliverable at this point. You could send that to somebody, and they can look at a black and white image without any further processing.
Okay.
And that's, we've actually, one of the great things that I like about OPC is that it's completely command line behind the scenes. So what we've done is I'll plug Visual Studio. We've used Microsoft VisualStudio.net to create a front end where we distribute the processing over our processing network. We have, 17 possible machines to process our data, depending on what time of day it is. Some of the machines are being used for other things during the day. But as you can see, we have different machines and different steps of processing. We use their multi-threading and multiple CPUs to process either 1 to 4 images per computer at a time. And by spreading that out, we're able to process. Here we did 500 images in about 2.5, 3 hours of processing.
Wow. So you've basically got like a distributed computing network, if
yep.
you will. And using Visual Studio, you wrote this application that's basically tapping straight into each of the cores of these machines
yep.
and then parallel processing all of the images at one
yep.
time.
Yeah. And it's very
really
pretty
cool.
simple to do with OPC. One of the great things about it is you just install OPC in all these computers. And you're able to tap in, we load the imagery and process it and load it back to the central location.
How does it communicate with the OPC instance on each machine?
We use SQL Server database. And SQL Server posts a job, and on each machine, it's querying the database to say, is there something for me to do? I'm done when I'm
Oh, really? You're using the job engine in SQL Server?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
So it's pretty neat. We've got a couple of really good programmers. They're able to take advantage of that, and it's just simply loading the job and saying where you want it, the same as in OPC. We've also gone a little step further, and we're actually able to take, for a lot of our other clients, they want a color image at the same resolution as the pan. So we're actually able to take the panchromatic data and the color data and do what's called a pan sharpening. And again, using OPC in the background, but OPC also has a lot of radiometry tools. You're able to do set up and save your radiometry, and then by doing that, you're able to distribute the processing the same as you would the level 2 processing.
Mm-hmm.
So we spent a lot of time and effort customizing it, and we think we're pretty proud of it. We've done over, I think the last count was about 450,000 images for Microsoft so far.
How many?
450,000.
Wow. That's a lot. And
yes.
400 plus megabytes an image.
Yeah, and I haven't even been able to figure out how many terabytes that is, but
it's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot. So, okay, so you process all this stuff. I love this app. It's doing all the parallel processing stuff, getting them all done up. And then, so what happens after the level two processing that you do then?
Well, then it's pretty old school, pretty much file, copy, and paste, basically. We're working on some, there is a way if we set up a share to a physical USB terabyte drive, we could actually process directly to the delivery hard drives if we wanted to, but that can also affect your performance. You know, you won't push it through as fast as if you're pushing it through to a server attached to a SAN.
Yep.
But otherwise, if we're doing lots of processing, we'll process to a central spot, hook up some drives, copy it down overnight, and it goes out the door.
That's it. And then what, you just ship it over to Boulder where they,
yep,
they take it from there?
Exactly.
Is that in one of those cases right there? Is that what you're...
These are actually what the DXs get shipped back and forth from the crews in. You can see they're pretty...
Oh, I see.
Pretty well padded for, yep, for protection, and they need it. They get mishandled nicely by the shipping companies, but they've held up real well. We just pack them up in the original packaging, the hard drives.
And just FedEx them over.
FedEx them. Yeah, we have a couple brands that we think are better than others that are nice sturdy metal cases. But
are these ruggedized in any way, or are they just the regular off the shelf types?
Regular off the shelf, but if you know, Lacey has these really hard metal cases.
Yep.
And I found that they've held up the best.
Yeah,
so, and we've shipped probably over 100, probably closer to 150 to Microsoft's, and we haven't had any problems with
them. Wow.
So,
well, that's awesome. Yep.
Yeah.
So the next step, I'm gonna go see what those guys in Boulder do with all this imagery you guys capture for us.
Yeah,
so.
I've heard you'll probably see like a room full of these boxes full of the data that we've captured.
Should I have them send some back? Recycle?
Yeah. I think that's their backup plan.
Okay.
Actually. So I don't think they would want to do that.
Okay. So. All right. Well, hey, David, thank you very much,
yeah,
man.
No problem.
Okay.